Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance podcast. And on behalf of the Coaching Academy today, we have a special guest with us. We have Coach G. Guerreri today, who is the head coach of the women's soccer team here at Texas A&M. Coach, welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're so glad to have you here. I'm going to tell the audience a little bit about you and about what we're going to talk about, and then we're just going to dive into the conversation.
Sounds good.
Here, it really is a true privilege to have Coach Guerreri here. He's probably one of the foremost women's soccer coaches in the country. This is starting his 22nd year as coach here at Texas A&M. In fact, he was the founder, the initial coach of the program, the only head coach that they've had at this point. This last year was especially good. The team was the co-conference champs and won the conference tournament. Over his tenure here, his team has been the conference champion or conference tournament champion 15 times?
14 times.
14 times.
Getting ahead of ourselves. This year 14. We hope to be 15.
Well, we're in advance then.
That's all right.
Matter of fact, team has played in every NCAA tournament in the last 19 seasons. He was named the SEC Coach of the Year this past year. Congratulations again.
Thank you.
A great honor. Yeah. He played at the University of Tulsa as a goalkeeper. He was the team MVP and made the All-Midwest team, coached at Tulsa, North Texas, Rollins College, Hardin-Simmons University, and Richland College before he got to Texas A&M, where he's found a home. Originally from Texas, too.
Grew up in Texas, originally from Chicago, actually, but we got here as fast as we could.
So, again, thanks for being with us today. You know,
This week
is a big week. World Cup starts, and we'll certainly talk about that. We want to talk about the women's game, though. We want to start with the women's game.
Okay.
What drew you to coaching?
Well, you know what? I have a lot of colleagues out there who kind of got into coaching late. Mm-hmm. They went through and they did kind of the traditional route through college and did the things that their parents wanted them to do, and they were going to be an accountant or they were going to be an engineer or they're going to be going to sales or something like that. And then after being out in the big bad world for a little while, they kind of figured out that I don't really enjoy this. I don't like waking up and going to that job every day. I'm on the opposite extreme of that, and I always knew what I wanted to do.
Hmm.
So probably since my first experience doing any coaching was I was about a sixth grader, and I helped out with my little sister's team.
Hmm.
And had a mom as the coach, and she had good intentions, but didn't really know anything about the game. And so I was about 3.5 years older than the girls on the team and was playing. And so she's like, you know, would you mind coming out and helping out a little bit? And I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed, you know, the impact that coaching could have, and that the ability to help people perform better was kind of, and to have for them to have a good time because of your input was kind of neat. And then when I was in high school, my first job was at the YMCA.
Mm-hmm.
And was teaching after school activity classes. So taught football, taught baseball, and then obviously taught soccer as well. And did that and refereed and stuff like that while I was still playing. And then, and even when I would come home in the summertime, I would help out a little bit at the Y. And so that kind of reinforced that it was something that I really enjoyed and I really had a passion for. And so I went through school as a phys ed major and got my degree in education from the University of Tulsa, and have been in it all the way. My advisors were trying to convince me that I needed to go into, you know, different parts of education. And I, after my sophomore year in college, I knew that the college level was really what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
It was I was really intrigued by the levels. I liked the challenges of it, and I was really good at it. So I felt like it was a good place for me. And so even as I finished my college career and tried to do a little bit of professional stuff, it was mostly just to gain experience to help me when I was going to start coaching, mm-hmm. which I knew was going to start pretty soon because I wasn't good enough to be a you know, a big professional player.
Well, you know, you're a real testament to this idea about following your passion. I mean, we talk to so many people who are very successful in their own fields, and they say, I just followed my passion. No matter what people told me, I knew what I wanted to do,
right,
and I did that. And right. So that's a good testament to that.
Right. Well, I mean, my father used to say all the time, because he didn't like his job, was, listen, if you ever find something that, you know, you really look forward to waking up and mm-hmm. going to, that's a good, that would be a good career. He goes, and that could be anything, you mm-hmm. know, and so for me, it was pretty easy. That's what I went to bed thinking about. I woke up in the morning thinking about, mm-hmm. and, you know, went through the whole day just kind of excited about what was around the next corner. And, you know, so now coaching at the college level, adds a lot more to the, you know, circumference all the way around the game, from a business side to a promotional side to a recruiting side to a little bit of everything, to maintenance and stuff like that. So that's over time has become you know, very interesting to me, and the administration of things has become very interesting to me. But in the purest sense, it was just, you know, hey, this is a way for me to help people, right, and have right. and really have fun.
Right. So how come you went into the women's game? There's probably a lot of people that don't appreciate the women's game.
Right. Well, I was coaching both. I was coaching, you know, when I came out of college, I was coaching men's soccer at the University of Tulsa, and then and at North Texas. They didn't have a women's program. And so when I went to Rollins College, which is a D2 school in Winter Park, Florida, just outside, you know, right next to Orlando, you know, I went kind of on a whim, a last-second thing. I decided to go. I knew a guy who was on the team who I was going to coach as a goalkeeper. And the head coach was like, yeah, well, come on over. Here's, you know, we can pay you these pittance. And and so when I got there, the athletic director said, listen, we have a women's club team. You know, I'll pay you an extra $1,000 to be the coach for the women's team. Mm. And I was like, sure, you know, it's fine with me. I got nothing else to do. And so – that was my first step into it, and really, really enjoyed it. I mean, the team, you know, we were not an extraordinary team, but, you know, we got better and better and better. I took a lot of pride in that. And I really enjoyed the response of the players. I mean, coaching women, coaching men there are differences to it. And not that I didn't enjoy coaching men, I really did, but I felt a bigger impact on the information and the just the way that the women would receive the information. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of got my feet wet. And then when I went to Hardin-Simmons in 88 to be the head men's and women's coach, you know, again, success was there. And then the opportunity, you know, kind of kept following as mm-hmm. far as being in it. And I didn't really, it wasn't until I came to A&M that I went all in on the women's side. I had always been head coach for both, and had always thought, you know, if I could just coach one team at a time, mm-hmm. I think I could do pretty good, you know, instead of coaching two teams at the same time in the same season. Was interesting. It was an interesting challenge, but it was kind of just where soccer was at the time.
Yeah. Now, the women's game certainly has grown exponentially.
Absolutely.
We recently talked to Coach Pat Henry, and he said one of the biggest changes for him in track and field has been the advent of the women's side of competition. How training has gotten so much better for the women. Their skill levels have come up very quickly. Do you see the same thing in soccer?
For sure. For sure. You know, and I've been in it long enough that from the mid to late 80s, when it was still a lot of dads coaching, to talking about youth athletes, to now where it's absolutely professional and it's become a really big business as far as coaching youth sports and specifically coaching youth soccer, you know, there's a heightened degree of skill coming through. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's funny because we see, you know, on the level has risen everywhere. Mm-hmm. The lower level is incredibly advanced compared to where it used to be. The highest end still is about the same. Mm-hmm. It hasn't really gone up, but the bottom has come up. Mm-hmm. And so it's made it to where across the board, the competition is better. The kids are able to do more things technically, tactically. They've been advanced because of a lot of the coaching that's gone into it. So it's been... you know, it's been revolutionary. And again, that was the early 90s, you know, and I remember the our Women's World Cup team in the first World Championships in 91 going and then coming back and really kind of coming back anonymously. And no one really, had any knowledge that they had won the world championship. And seeing video, and a buddy of mine went over to it, and I saw a lot of video afterwards. And honestly, it was a pretty poor tournament. I mean, the United States just ran roughshod over everybody. And compare that then to 99 when it exploded with Mia Hamm and Christine Lilly and obviously Brandi Chastain and her, you know, taking the shirt off after the penalty kick and all that stuff. You know, and then people kind of discovered, hey, these are some really neat people who are playing the sport. You know, and then from that point on, like I said, I was at a game this past weekend in Portland in the NWSL, and there was over 10,000 people at the game for a women's professional league match. So it's been neat to see. There's been a lot of progress in it, and you know, and now it's a point where it's kind of embraced as a real opportunity for competitive young women to take on.
Right. Well, it's interesting that whereas the U.S. men's program has tried to play catch-up on the world scene, the U.S. women's program has led the world scene
the last 20 years. Because they started at the top. And again, a lot of that you can look at, the best nations initially were the nations that had the most freedom for women and the most opportunities for women. You look at
Excellent point. At
Northern Europe, you look at Western Europe, you look at North America. And then, again, they were, I think, forced into it in China. So it was a deal where those were the main programs. And now, as the 2015 World Cup for women comes up next year, you know, you'll see a lot of parity. I mean, Europe has really embraced it. Asia has done very well. The Japanese are fantastic. So the next things are the African nations and and the South American nations, which, again, can be a cultural thing as well as how, opportunities for women progress in that part of the world.
Yeah. Now, you just mentioned the World Cup for women, and we'll come back to that a little bit, but certainly the big media event that's starting this week is the World Cup.
It's not just a media event.
Well, I guess that's my question for Americans that don't maybe not pay as much attention to soccer as most of us do, or many of us do. What's the big deal? What's the big deal about the World Cup?
Well, it's an opportunity for a lot of places around the world to raise their flag and to really have a lot of pride in what their nationality does in a game that crosses all borders and as a game without borders. So,
I mean, you do see teams like from Uruguay and Portugal and teams that you don't normally hear of as from being sports-related countries.
Netherlands, speed skating. Yeah. I mean, the Netherlands, this is what they do. Yeah. And again, the African nations are outstanding. Belgium is one of the teams that people are talking about the most going into this World Cup. And so, there's a lot of money in the game now, but even back before there was, astronomical figures in there, it was a chance to kind of show, hey, this is what we do in this field, in world football. And so whether you're talking about, South American football with the Argentinians and the Brazilians and the Uruguayans, or you're talking about, Asian football and what was happening in Korea, or you're talking about, the different parts of Europe and the dominance in those. And then with us, obviously, with CONCACAF and North America coming through with Mexico and the United States and Canada being the leading ones, Canada's kind of fallen off lately. But it's a real chance for people to say, hey, this is what identifies our country, and we're going to go for that. And for Americans, I mean, you ask someone, so what are you? Obviously, we're Americans, but I'm Italian, I'm a German. For Americans, it's a chance to, even kind of root for our heritage a little bit as we go forward. So it's been really cool to see, as far as an American, in 1978, I was in middle school and coming through and getting ready for high school when the World Cup was in Argentina, and playing in a police state in those days, and there was no television of the World Cup. Some friends of mine went down to watch the final on closed circuit TV in Dallas, and I remember them coming back, and I was mad because I didn't get an invitation to go. But and then in '82 was the aha moment for me, and that was I was a sophomore in college then. And so it was a it was the first time that it was on television all the time. It was only on Spanish speaking television, and then I think
amazing how quickly you pick up Spanish that way, though.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, sucking them in, all the stuff. I had no idea what it was, and yeah. Now I knew what a quipo and all these things were. And anyway, the final I think was part of Wide World of Sports. Mm. They carried it as their final as one of their broadcasts of the World Cup final from Spain. And again, for me and for my peers, you know, we were up every morning for the 10 a.m. game. Then there was I think a 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon game, and you know, we would specifically meet to watch it and learn our Spanish for the day, and it was awesome. And that was, and then 86, it kind of crept in again a little bit more with it being in Mexico. And I'd just gotten out of college in 86, and went down with about nine or we went down with 10 guys. Mm-hmm. So me and nine other guys, and you know, it's one of the, there's a lot of experiences in there that were just, you know, over the moon, and right. things that will always be with us. And the guys who were part of it, you know, it's something that we share, and we always wanted to get back and go to more World Cups, but life happened for a lot of guys, and right. they never really got a chance to do it. But that for us was, I remember the walking into Azteca Stadium for the
big stadium
for
people who aren't familiar with it,
114,000,
yeah,
and it's vertical. And so I remember walking in, and it was for a Mexico game, and you know, we didn't have tickets, and so here are 10 of us who don't, you know, 9 of us don't speak English, and we're just kind of trying to haggle for tickets to try to get a ticket. And we all get tickets independently of each other. So we kind of walk in, and then we have to go to different parts of the stadium. Well, I remember coming through the portal into the stadium where, you know, you're kind of back in the bowels of the stadium, and you kind of step out, and woof, all this color, and there was a, you know, a buzz from, like, vuvuzelas, we call them now, but a buzz to it. And I remember literally having to kind of step back against the wall, because it really took my breath away. And that was a moment for me at that time as a soccer player, that I was like, this is bigger than anything I've ever imagined. And I remember I was actually interviewed by USA Today, ironically, while we were there. And you know, one of my quotes was, you know, it was phenomenal. It was, you know, the stadium is two Texas stadiums on top of each other, which it pretty much was.
Right.
And that was it for me. I mean, I'm hooked. I mean, absolutely. I was already all in, and this meant it to where, okay, this is something that, you know, I've been inspired. I want to make this, you know, part of what I'm going to do forever.
Yeah. So for the folks listening, of course, as we said, World Cup starting, for if you don't know, that's the 32 teams that have qualified plus mm-hmm. the host nation, and they're in groups of four. Eight groups of four, and U.S. has drawn what they call the group of death, because we have Ghana and Portugal and Germany in there, all big powerhouses in and of themselves.
And teams that we have traditionally struggled against. Mm. You know, huge win over Portugal in 2002, which I'm sure that they've been reminded of, you know, 10 or 11,000 times. But, yeah, it's a really tough draw for the U.S. But you know what? It's the U.S. team is as good as we get better and better and better. As, you know, on the men's side, you know, soccer has gone head and shoulders. I remember seeing a match on television about a year ago. It was a replay of our men's national team playing against England at Wembley, and I think it must have been post World mm-hmm. Cup in '94. Mm-hmm. And we were bad. I mean, we just, you know, Alexi Lalas, as much as he talks, he was a terrible player compared to what we have now.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, but at the time he was the
best we had.
He and Balbo in the middle of the park, that was what we had, and they did a great job of getting it. But
and Miola in the goal.
To compare that stuff to now, yeah. is I mean, we've come a long way. Unfortunately, we were stuck in a pretty difficult group.
Yeah. So of the three games that we're going to be playing, which one are you looking forward to watching the most? Of the Ghana, we play Ghana first, and then I think we play Portugal and Germany third.
You know, I really don't put any of them over. I'm 100% on all of them. Mm. I want to see. You know, I got to tell you, I'm worried about all of them too, because I'm worried about we've struggled against the Ghanaians because of their physical prowess and their their ability to kind of thwart us and some of the power that they have in different places. The Germans, same thing. They've dominated us, particularly in the air. People talk about how technical they are. But what I've seen of our last six games against the Germans is we've struggled with them when it's become an aerial battle, when the ball leaves the ground, which is, you know, I don't think enough people take into account. Now, we beat one of their B teams a couple of years ago. And then the Portuguese, you've got the best player in the world with Cristiano Ronaldo. And, you know, in all of these games, you know, I would be shocked if our best player was in the top five
of their team.
On the field.
Wow.
And that's, I don't mean anything against our players, but just saying how good the other teams are. So, you know, and again, it'll be interesting. The people who are just kind of fly by and aren't really paying attention will, if it goes as planned and we don't get through the group, which we shouldn't get through the group based on what we have, you know, the response will be, oh, well, soccer will never make it in this country. And the rest of us will be like, smile, okay, you guys go back over there and we'll carry on.
Right, right.
But if Klinsmann can get him through, and I think he's an excellent coach, you know, it'll be another big step forward for the game.
So of the players that we have that we know they're going to be starting, which one would you tell our audience to probably watch the most, that their performance probably will be the bellwether for the team?
Michael Bradley is our best player. He's number four. He's easy to find because he has a shaved head. he's in the middle of the park. He's a coach's son, and he's a really, really special player. He's very, very good. He's our can opener. Mm. He's the one that will kind of unlock a lot of tight defenses because of his ability to spray balls around distribution-wise. But he's also got great range, great physical capacity to be able to get all around the park, and he works his tail off. So
yeah.
he's a great role model player for a lot of aspiring, you know, best players on their teams. He's a great kid to watch.
Yeah. Now, as Americans, though, we have to give a shout-out to the goalkeepers.
Well, Tim Howard is awesome.
We've got excellent goalkeepers.
And we always have, you know. And personally, it goes back into our culture. We are a eye-hand-coordinated culture growing up where, you know, our dads took us out in the park to throw the baseball and those things. Those are often the first things that most of our people have done. Well, you know, in the past 40 years, it's become a little bit more okay to go out and kick the ball around a little bit. But we have that base of eye-hand coordination through, and especially through our other sports, which are predominantly, you know, that way. Mm-hmm. So you go back, you know, Tim Howard's fantastic, Casey Keller before him, Brad Friedel, Tony Miola, you know, those are all, you know.
See, I go back to Shep Messing.
Shep Messing, yeah, who, flamboyant
for sure.
Cosmos days. But absolutely, you know, as a matter of fact, one of the first books I read on in soccer was Shep Messing's autobiography, which is pretty cool. That, you know, I remember one thing where he was saying only Shep scores on Shep. He went through one season where no one scored. And he always wanted to turn around and volley the ball into the back of the goal to show that he was the only one that could score himself. And I like that cockiness of the American bravado in sport. But from a goalkeeper side of things, Tim Howard is special. He's really, really good. You know, and he's a neat story. He's a guy, he has Tourette syndrome. He's always had to kind of accommodate for a lot of things outside of his control, and he's done a great job. He's become a very, very good professional, and you know, he'll come on broadcast now on NBC Sports because he plays for Everton in Liverpool. And so a lot of times you'll hear him on a Sunday match. If he played on Saturday, he'll be on a Sunday match if, you know, United are playing, which is 30 miles away, or Liverpool is playing, or one of the other teams in that area of the country. And he does a great job. I mean, he comes across incredibly intelligent and obviously well connected in what's going on. So he's a guy that can erase a lot of our mistakes. But, you know, it's the world. The eyes of the world literally will be on our players. And so as someone who's helped to coach and helped to try to develop a lot of the game, it's we take a lot of pride in it, but we are definitely – I'm holding my breath as we go through it.
Now, Coach Klinsmann, the national team coach, has gone on record in media saying that we don't have any chance to win the cup And I'm saying that in the media. Is he playing like a Lou Holtz thing? And
sounds like Lou Holtz said, like, Navy's going to kill us.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And but behind the scenes, he's, you know, the guys are going to be fired up by that. Or as a coach, what do you think about that kind of strategy?
Perhaps. I think, you know, again, to each his own. As far as he's always been a very honest guy. You know, he's kind of beyond reproach and in what he has done in his credibility. He's clearly earned his credibility as obviously as a great player, but also as a high level coach. And part of, you know, what he has said over and over going into this is that the United States is going to be the most fit team in the tournament,
and it's
going to
be hot down there.
It is, and you know, and we have the worst. Not only do we have the worst or the toughest group, but for a lot of people, but we also have the worst travel. It's not like we're just going to, you know, our training site is in Sao Paulo or just outside Sao Paulo, but we're playing in, you know, the equivalent of, you know, being based in, you know, based in Houston, and we're going to play games in Minneapolis, Philadelphia, and you know, and Denver.
Yeah, I think I read that we're going to travel 9,000 miles.
It's crazy.
Or something. Yeah,
it's really, really crazy. So, so he has to deal with a lot of that. So, you know, like we said, we don't have the best. We're not going to have the best player in the field. Michael Bradley is a special kid, but he's not Cristiano Ronaldo. He's not Pickup German. He's not Schweinsteiger. He's not those guys. So, as a coach, you know, you got to pick what you can do. You know, and you've got to figure out what that's going to be. And you know, for as Americans, we are. Our athletes are developed, and we have speed. We have size, and so we have control over our fitness. We have control over the things that we can put into our effort. And I think that's a lot of what his preparation has been about. And I don't question that at all. That's the way it should be. Yeah. The tactics of how he's going to have our chess pieces set up, that'll be under him. He had a good result against Nigeria going in, which I rate Nigeria as a good side. If you listen to the pundits on television and radio, you know, we don't have a chance. But for someone who's come through the game, the fact that we have people talking about it is exciting.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that Sirius is doing, you know, has a full-time soccer channel, fantastic. All the soccer that's on TV, it's come so far. So let the talking heads make their money and do what they want. And again, I don't predict anything on it other than the fact I think Brazil will win the tournament as the host nation and as the most, you know, arguably the most talented soccer country year after year after year. But man, there's gonna be a lot of great games. Be a lot of great games. There'll be a lot of tight games. Again, I look forward to seeing what the South Americans are gonna do. And what the Africans are going to do. Those are the unknown qualities, because we see a lot of these players who are based in Europe play. So I feel like I have a pretty good working knowledge of a lot of those countries, but man, I just don't know much about the African teams other than every year. And again, I go back to 1982 when Cameroon, you know, got a great result in the first match against Argentina. Right. You know, these teams are talented and athletic, just like we talk about. And
everyone sat up and said, "Hey, wait, something's going on over there."
Yeah. Well, and they're—I mean, obviously, it's a great example of, you know, economies that are challenged economically, but you know, great human resources that can really perform on a big stage.
Now, you mentioned something a few minutes ago. And this will be our last topic here before we start to wrap up. That I think is really important to understand, and is as we talk about the exposure now, you and I have been around the game long enough that we can remember when no one ever talked about soccer. And
right.
One of the things that happened has been the explosion in youth programs over the last 30 years in particular. And so the last thing I want to ask you, I know you're going to spend most of your summer starting this next Saturday doing youth soccer camps. Why should parents encourage their children to play soccer if they're going to play any sport?
Well, I mean, I'm a big proponent it's a fact that kids who participate in sports and in athletics develop great leadership skills. They develop great social skills, sometimes through trial and error. And that, you know, you look around at the leaders of our societies, you know, they have backgrounds in sports in one way or another. And it might have been only when they were in the third grade, but, you know, those types of experiences are helpful to them. And it's something to It's healthy. It's exciting.
It's a lot of running.
It's a lot of running, but you know what?
Which is good.
You know what? I grew up as a baseball fan. You know, my first sports activities were playing baseball, going to Cub games as a little kid. Mm. You know, my kids never really got into baseball because it's too much standing in line and waiting. Mm-hmm. And so you look at now soccer and you look at the how lacrosse is going, same ideas. A lot of movement. You know, it allows kids to get out and do things. It's funny, too, because the other part that people talk about as a negative of, you know, the current culture with our kids is, you know, all these video games the kids are playing. Well, my youngest son really gets into a lot of video games and he enjoys it. But he's also a soccer player and he plays basketball and yada, yada, yada. But I have a part of my house where basically it's my cave where I can watch games. And so on Saturday and Sunday mornings, that's where I'll be oftentimes early on watching a Premier League match. And Connor will come in and he and his brother play a lot of FIFA on Xboxes. And so he's like going, he'll come in and he's like, "So who's playing, Dad?" I go, "Well, this is Arsenal against Manchester United." And he'll start clicking off names of guys on both teams. And I'm like, look at him going, "Where? How do you know these?" And he's like, and he goes, "Oh yeah, I played this game yesterday." And I was like, "Oh, okay." He goes, "Yeah, so you know, you've got to watch out because you know Rooney is very good at doing this." I'm like, "Okay, well, fair enough. It's another way of learning the game." Yeah. And so there's a lot of people who aren't really, don't even associate with our particular game as players, but you know they play it on a video game. Jeffrey's a basketball player, played at Indiana, played in the NBA. He came and spoke to our team once preseason. And he goes, "You know, I don't really follow soccer that much, but I play the FIFA on the computer." We're like going, "Okay, fair enough. Then you're in, man. Yeah. You can sort of speak our language." And again, a lot of people I think have come to kind of respect the game itself, but you can't help but respect the passion that people have for the game. And as a coach here at Texas A&M, it's one of the things that we've been able to really it's fit into our culture well of the 12th man of what the students do at football games and baseball games to come and do the same thing at soccer games. And you know it's been a lot of fun as the guy on the other side of the line. It's been neat to see the effect that can have on our players and maybe the way that our players can inspire other people.
Yeah, shout out to our students because we've led the league in student attendance at most of the games. I think.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, and have been in the national top three for well over a decade.
Yeah, Coach, thank you so much for being here with us today. We've really enjoyed it, and regular listeners of our podcast will know that this is the time we give our guests an opportunity to give us their take-home message. What do you want people to remember?
Well, again, I think that the biggest thing is to understand that that sports builds leaders, and to encourage your kids and encourage people in your family to be active participants in sport. And obviously, if you can get out there and play, it's a great thing. But even if you can't, and you can get out there and you can coach and you can help out with youth sports. You know, you're really helping the next generation, and you'll help yourself at the same time. You'll find that, you know, there's a lot of enjoyment in helping other people and helping them to find their passion.
Great take-home message. Thanks again. And for those of you that are listening, we'll put on the show notes, Coach G certainly, he has a blog at coachg.com, and he has a weekly radio show in the season that I think you can pick up online as well. It's always fun to listen to. And so, again, we'd like to thank you, Coach, for being here with us.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. And, again, regular listeners know that this is the time of the podcast that we usually ask the podcast question of the week. Here with the podcast question of the week is Cheryl.
How many teams qualify for the World Cup?
So be the first one to send us the answer to that question at huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of those nifty podcast T-shirts that we have. And so until next week, we're going to sign off. We hope that you join us next week for another interesting person in the world of sports medicine and human performance. And until then, we hope you stay active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Kelly Selman and Aidland Letzinger and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sidney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.